chapter 22 tonight. You'll notice this morning I stopped at verse 19. Verse 20 and 24 kind of concludes that chapter, and it's really an interesting passage. I think he's introducing this because he's going to come back to it later when we get to talking about Isaac and looking for a bride for Isaac. So he's kind of laying some early groundwork here as he's writing the narrative. And then we move into chapter 23 where finally Sarah dies and Abraham mourns for her and ends up purchasing the cave of Machpelah there and has that possession for in the promised land. And so I just want to read that. Let's read verse 19 or verse 20 through 24. And then we'll continue just through 23. Remember, by the way, while we're reading this, remember what's already passed in chapter 22. Because these things are happening on the heels of that. Abraham, and as I've said, I think chapter 22 was the climax of Abraham's life, his spiritual life. I think Abraham's faith was refined to its highest point at that moment. And I think his vision was clearer at that moment than it would ever be anymore. I believe God revealed to him these things regarding the gospel and the seed, plural or singular, that through whom the world would be blessed. I believe Abraham was resting now, spiritually resting in what God had revealed to him. And so immediately we move into this genealogy or this information regarding relatives, his brothers, children specifically. So verse 20, concluding the chapter, reads this way. Now it came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Now you remember Nahor traveled with Terah, his father, to Haran. And then God called Abraham out of Haran to come to the land that he would show him. And as far as we know, Nahor stayed there in the area of Haran with his father, Terah. Of course, their dad died. Terah died before Abraham ever left. But all indications are that Haran generally stayed in that area where they had settled in Haran. So that's where he is now. Verse 21, Uz his firstborn and Buz his brother and Kemuel the father of Aram. And Chesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Verse 23, Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. So you see there, he's laying groundwork now. He's going to come back to that later on. But Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. His concubine, whose name was Reumah, also bore Teba, and Gaham, and Teish, and Maacah. So I think the reason that's there is because this climax of Abraham's life has happened, and now we're moving from that narrative to the closing, as it were, the closing of Abraham's life in this world. So we're in the latter years of his life now, and we're going to go immediately from this little insertion regarding his brother, because Abraham's going to come back to that as a part of his latter years. He needs to know that. So we don't know who brought him the information or how he gained the information, but someone shared with him, hey, Nahor, your brother who remained in Haran as you've been following the Lord, he's had children, and his children have had children. And so you have a kinsman, at least by blood. They weren't Canaanites, but they weren't the same as Canaanites. And we'll find out later on that he does not want anyone to take a bride for his daughter from the Canaanites. So he sends them back to there. So this chapter here is laying the groundwork for what the writer's going to come back to and deal with Isaac later on. And so all that's in the context of Abraham's life now is coming to a close. And then in chapter 23, we pick up with Sarah's death. So Sarah's life does come to a close, and we have the narrative of that. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my lord, you are a mighty princess among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, "If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and approach Ephraim the son of Zohar for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field. For the full price let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site." Now Ephraim was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephraim the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all who went in at the gate of the city, saying, "Now know, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." And Abraham bowed before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephraim in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, "If you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there." Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between me and you? So bury your dead." Abraham listened to Ephron. And Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field that were within all the confines of its border, were deeded over, that's an important phrase, were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of sons of Heth, before all who went into the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. And so that's the narrative in regards to the end of Sarah's life. She's 127 years old here. She was 90. She was 90 when she bore Isaac. Then Isaac is 37 at this point, at the point of his mother's death. But one of the where I want to just concentrate tonight is in the context of all that's happened in Abraham's life, in regards to what's been shown to him there on the mount, and in the process of what we shared this morning, the sacrifice of Isaac, or the commanded sacrifice of Isaac, God's intervening, and just the glory of the gospel that he was exposed to there. As I say, I think that's the climax of Abraham's spiritual maturity in this life. He is as refined a faith at that point as he's ever going to have. Now, I'm not saying was Abraham perfect. I'm not saying that, but there is a reason that the New Testament writers point back to the faith of Abraham as the exemplary, as exemplary of what the faith that justifies is all about. They refer to him. Paul refers to him. Peter makes mention of him too, as well, I believe, and certainly in the book of Acts. Stephen, as he's martyred, makes reference to this as well. So that is the epitome of what saving, justifying faith is. It is believing God. That's the pinnacle of Abraham's life. All of his life, from his childhood even to that point, was for the purpose of this revelation to Abraham and God choosing Abraham and working through him to bring about the fulfillment of the seed of the promise. So that's the climax of his life. Now, that having passed, now we immediately move into the kind of the close of Abraham's life. There was 37 years past there, so we're not giving details regarding the growing up of Isaac all the way until he was 37 years old and then told that Sarah became sick and Sarah passed away. We jump completely past those years intervening, and we go directly to this information that Abraham receives in regards to Nahor, his son, his brother, and the children that he has. And then the writer, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, gives us this information to set the stage for coming back to the subject later on. So my point, where I'm coming from tonight, is that there is a time in the life where we are preoccupied, as it were, almost totally with the pursuit of God. Pursuit of faith and growing in relationship to God. But then there's a place, I think, in the latter years where our focus seems to start changing somewhat. In other words, there are promises that I'm holding to that I am not going to experience personally in this life. They're way out into the future, and it may be generations before the possession happens. So their minds turn from the pursuit of God more to preparing for the pursuit of the generations until that time. And I think that's the shift you see here. Abraham has reached the, as it were, the pinnacle of his life, and God's using him as an instrument here through which Isaac would come, and Isaac, ultimately the seed, Christ himself, would come. So God, all the work that he's done in Abraham's life has sort of climaxed here on Mount Moriah, and then the years following are kind of the closing chapters now of Abraham's life. So it's interesting to see what's Abraham thinking about at that point. Is he still pursuing God? Is he still, I'm not saying that he isn't in his own way, but it seems like the focus now, the preoccupation of Abraham now, given the revelation that he's had on Mount Moriah, shifts to the generations that will follow. Not only Isaac, but down through Isaac and the generations that follow. And that was interesting. I wrote this just trying to think through this in my mind, but just bear with me as I read verbatim. But I wrote this: living faithfully and in obedience is a lifelong pursuit. And in early life, as well as in our prime, it is often our preoccupation. And though that pursuit does not cease in our latter years, if we have been faithful living in obedience, it becomes more natural to us, or perhaps to some degree less disruptive to our fleshly desires, since in great part those fleshly desires have been crucified through the pursuit of God through many years. The old man has been being put away in sanctification. In those latter years, then, we might give more intentional thought to the generations that follow us, knowing of the battles yet ahead of them, and knowing ourselves how easily we might have fallen in our own battles. So then we might conclude that our parting faithfulness should take the form of preparing them and pointing them to the Lord, or of setting in place objects or circumstances that might serve to them as bulwarks and guardrails in their lives to direct them towards faithfulness to the end of their days. And to me, that seems to be the transition that's happening here. Abraham knows things in regards to relating to God, in regards to faith, and in regards to redemption that nobody else knows. I mean, he's had this personal experience. Only Isaac, even from Isaac's perspective, he only knows what he experienced on Mount Moriah. He don't know the decades of shaping and bending and crushing that took place in the life of his father to bring him to this faithfulness on Mount Moriah. He doesn't know any of that. Only Abraham knows these things. And Abraham also knows that I am not going to take possession in this life of this land. Although it's promised, and I believe it with all my heart, and I have just been to the mount and raised the knife over my own son in demonstration of my certainty of that promise, I will not possess it. And so my faithfulness now, rather than turning to fighting the battle as to whether or not I shall possess it in this life, it shifts now to preparing my son Isaac and the generations that follow him for their inheritance of it. It may be that they will be possessing it. It may be that it'll be generations beyond them. But my duty in old age is to lay the groundwork for the generations who follow me to learn of God what I've learned of God through my own experiences. To me, that should be a guiding principle, certainly for parents, in the back of our minds as we're living our lives, because we're teaching our children many things then, but particularly when we get beyond and our children are gone and they have children of their own and we're growing older in our years and our pursuit of God doesn't stop all of our lives. But at a certain point, we realize that there are promises of God that I have not yet fully experienced in this life. For whatever reasons, God has not provided for that experience in my life, but it is promised. And so what should I do in my life to prepare the generation after me to experience those things which I have not personally experienced, but am sure that are to be possessions that we have? In a spiritual sense, I think in these terms often. I want my daughter to know far more in her relationship and intimacy with God than I've ever known.
And I think sometimes that the life that I've lived and the battles that I've fought have predisposed me not to be able to experience certain things. So I want to put guardrails in place in her life more so now than I did at 35. More so now at 57, I want to put guardrails and bulwarks in place where I can that'll keep her on this track to experiencing this God that I've experienced to a far greater degree and depth than I have experienced Him. So that she and I and the generations who follow might all one day together experience the fullness of the possession, and it would be ours forever. And that's what I think you see in Abraham. And you see that introduced here by this sudden, apparently sudden introduction or information that comes to him regarding Nahor, his brother. I mean, the fact that it's mentioned suggests to me that Abraham had a mind, even at that point, what about Isaac? How do I make provision for Isaac that he might stay on this narrow path that leads him towards experiencing the fullness of God that I have experienced, and even more so? In other words, the emphasis becomes less your experience with God and more can others experience Him in this way and even more so. Anybody, I say this, but anybody that has ever experienced the presence of God in your life, you will want for everyone you love, you will want them to know more of that. Because what I feel when I evaluate my experiences with God and consider that He is infinitely glorious, I mourn at times that I have not known Him more. Because there's much more to be known. And so at a certain age, and I'm nearing my death particularly, I begin to think to myself, it might not be probable or likely that I will know Him to much greater of a degree than I do at this point. But my children can. And so what can I do to make preparation that they might know Him more fully? That's what I think you see going on here. He introduces him and says to him, the information comes to Abraham. It was told him, you're not told who he told him, but it was told Abraham, behold, Milcah has also borne children to your brother Nahor. So clearly, Abraham is dwelling among the Canaanites, and they are pagans. And Abraham knows if my son takes a wife of the Canaanites, he will be very much influenced by their idolatry, and there will be likelihoods that he will miss some glorious reality about this God that I've come to know. And so I want to, as much as I can, to prevent him from marrying this. Now, we don't have any guarantees that Nahor was much more godly, but at least he was kinfolk. He was blood kin, and perhaps Abraham was thinking, I might have some influence in him. After all, Nahor surely had gotten information of how God had prospered Abraham. And perhaps Nahor was inclined to be more open to Abraham's life and Abraham's belief in theology in regards, especially considering how God had blessed him while he was in a pagan land. So my point is that Abraham was apparently thinking in terms of, what am I going to do about Isaac? I'm living in Canaan. And yes, it's going to be our possession, but God has revealed to me at this Mount Moriah experience that I'm not going to possess it and that it may be generations before it actually is our possession. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, one of the things I've got to do as a father is I've got to put some guardrails in place to make sure that my son and the generations that follow are moving in the right direction towards that possession, not away from it. And Canaanite intermarrying will be moving him away from it. Nahor may, but the chances are less likely. So we are introduced here to Nahor. I think because Abraham was thinking along those lines. He's preparing because he knows that his days are coming to an end. In fact, in chapter 24, we're going to read that Abraham does die. Full of years and full of life, Abraham's days are concluded here. And I think Abraham knows that's near. even if he doesn't know specifically, even if he doesn't have a revelation from God that is upon him, he knows that his years are piling up and his body doesn't cooperate like it once does. I am getting older. I have an appointment that everybody around me that has gone on to be with the Lord has kept, and I cannot avoid it. So I need to be preparing the generations. I think there's something wise about thinking in our latter years, particularly of the generations that follow. I mean, you think about how we've neglected in some ways, maybe for a couple of generations to do that, and look where the generation is now. What responsibility does our generation and maybe the one before us have in what they see in this present generation? If they've rejected God, is it because they saw us serving God and worshiping God in superficial ways that weren't real and weren't life-changing and transformative? Have they saw us just checking the boxes and it seemed to them like futility, and therefore they have denied or rejected what we claimed we believed? What role do we have in the generations that follow? Abraham seems here to be thinking now after Moriah, after the mount, he seems to be thinking now of what he can do in his remaining years to put in place things that will help the following generations to walk with the Lord and to follow the Lord and to pursue him. Having thought about that preparation and coming back to that in chapter 24, I think I misspoke a minute ago. It's chapter 25 where Abraham dies, but 24 is where they look for a bride for Isaac. Having introduced that, coming back to that in 24, he also deals here with the loss of Sarah. Now, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. To me, it was interesting. I was writing this in regards to that, the suggestion that Abraham has been to the mount. God has commanded the unthinkable. He believed God. His faith held. He received his son as though from the dead. His faith has seen. The possession will not be his for many generations. That's what happened on Mount Moriah that is dictating now what happens after you come down from Moriah. And I think that's exactly what you see in Abraham's life. So as I said, in chapter 23, we're introduced to that Sarah passes, Sarah dies. I had written in my notes, Her pilgrimage comes to its conclusion. And Abraham knows that his is soon to follow at some point. Sarah lived 27 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So at 127 years, she dies. Verse 1 and 2 says that Abraham mourns for her and weeps. Oh, how he must have wept. I mean, she's been through these battles in large part with him. She's experienced the consequences. She's had her own errors. She's been responsible in some ways in presenting him with opportunities to make errors and to move away from God. And they both fought this battle for faith together. Now, I don't think she had the experience of Abraham, but I've often wondered, did Abraham ever tell her what happened on Moriah? Because you can imagine a mother, you did what? Sarah, I took your son, the one you treasured, and I took him up on the mountain, and God told me to sacrifice him there. Thankfully, God intervened, and I didn't have to follow through with that, but I was going to. I don't know how that would land on a wife, particularly on Sarah, but she was in the battle with him. She was with him all these years as God was chiseling and hammering, and she was taken away twice to be in the palace of other kings, taken away from her husband twice, essentially kidnapped in some ways, taken away. She had endured these things as God shaped the faith of this man, her husband, Abraham, and in part her own as well. And finally, Sarah's pilgrimage is over. She dies at 127 years. As I said, that would mean, I think, that Isaac is about 37 now when she dies. So Isaac is a grown man. Not soon they're going to be looking for him a bride, but he's a grown man and his mother dies. I thought that was interesting because I was telling someone recently, we were having a conversation, but I said, one thing about ministry, Brother Mike can testify to this, and probably both Mikes, One thing about ministry is you never get far from the sensibility of your own mortality. Because as soon as you get to thinking life's going to go on forever, somebody calls and says, hey, a loved one died. Could you help us with the funeral? And so you have to prepare a funeral, and you have to bring, hopefully, scriptures from the truth of God's word that will encourage them in their grief and in their mourning. But you're doing all that and you're ministering, but in the back of your mind, you always know this day is coming for me. In just a word of personal testimony, my grandfather died at 14. I never went to a funeral and refused to go to another funeral after my grandfather died, because I did not like to be confronted with the fact that that day is ahead of me. I've shared before, I watched the casket go close on his face, and I remember, I can see it just as clear today in my mind's eye as I could that day. But when that casket door came closed, I watched the shadow cast across his face. And when it shut and they turned those things and I watched it seal down, the first question in my mind was, now what? Or, if anything. And so I didn't go to another funeral until I was a Christian after I was 29 years old. So from 14 years old all the way probably into my mid-30s, I refused to go to a funeral, because that funeral reminded me that that is an appointment that we all have to keep. Well, Abraham's been to the mountain. He's seen things that God has shown him on that mountain. He's opened his eyes, that ram in the bushes I was speaking of this morning, the lamb that was to come, how God was going to bless the nations. He has had glorious revelations here. But Abraham knows that he is at the latter end of his life, and he's thinking in terms of, how do I make preparation for Isaac and for the generations to follow him? So that tells me that he knows that my life here on this earth is not much longer. And then his wife Sarah dies. His lifelong companion Sarah dies, and he goes in and mourns and weeps for her, and he cannot come away from that experience without understanding that Sarah is gone and my time is very near. I've thought about this, and some of you know what I mean here, but at a certain age when your parents pass, is there not a change in the way you think about death? Doesn't it have an impact on you? Because in my mind, it suggests to me that when she passed, my mom, when she passes, then there will be no one between me and that appointment. In other words, If normal things unfold as statistically normal, then as long as my mom's alive, there's somebody between me and my appointment. But when my mom leaves the world, there's nobody in the way. There's nobody that has to go before I go. I'm next. And my kids should probably feel the same way. When I'm gone, as long as I'm alive, they can say, well, there's one person between me and that appointment. Now, I know things can happen, and I may have to keep the appointment before they do, but generally speaking, they'll keep the appointment before I do because of the number of their years. But when they're gone, there's nobody keeping me. There's nobody blocking me from the day of my appointment. Now it's just a matter of the years that unfold. And I can't help but believe that Abraham, that came home to him very, very clearly at Sarah's death. He was already thinking in that direction when he's thinking about, what are we going to do with Isaac? How do we make preparation? Now Sarah is gone. And I think the preparation becomes even more urgent here. But he deals with that. And I love the way Abraham deals with that, because even in these latter years, it's almost as if he's thinking in terms of, how can I go about seeing to the necessary arrangements to have my wife's body buried, and do that in such a way that it leaves an influence or a legacy in regards to the generations who will follow me. How can I do that? And I love why we have such detail in the way this comes about. Look at this really closely. Abraham does the proper mourning, verse 3. Then Abraham, verse 2, after he weeps and mourns, verse 3, then Abraham rose up before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, those who were primarily in charge of the land in which he was dwelling. And notice this, at this old age, after the glorious experience of Mount Moriah, and after all that God had accomplished in the life of Abraham, here in this place, near the end of his days, he says to them, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. And that just struck me. He's She's 90. She died at 127. That's 37 years after she had Isaac. He's 100 when Isaac is born, so he's 137. He's 137 years old. And he's been in this area, and he's grown, and God has blessed him, and God has given him the foresight to see all the glory, or at least a glimpse of the glory that is to be the possession of the people descended through Abraham. And even in this age, late age, he says to them, humbly, I am a stranger and a pilgrim in this land. That tells me that Abraham has come to the conclusion now that he will never possess in this life what God has promised. In fact, the writer to Hebrews seems to indicate that that's what sustained Abraham. That's why he could be patient in this life, as Lot chose the fertile area around Sodom, and Abraham took the less fertile area that was left. How could he be so patient in that? Because the Hebrew writer suggested, because Abraham was looking for a city whose builder was God. I'm looking for something beyond this land. I'm looking for something superior to this land, so I can be patient and dwell here as a pilgrim, even though I do not possess it. We do know that we will one day, as descendants of Abraham, possess it in its glorified form, in its purified form. It will be our possession, but until then, we're to live as pilgrims. And here Abraham is. If anyone ever had a right to assert some claim or some validation for his presence in Canaan, it was Abraham. But he doesn't do that. It says something to me about the maturity of Abraham's faith, but it also says something to me about what Abraham wants to leave as a legacy for his children, because they're going to be pilgrims in the land for a long time. And I believe Abraham realized that. And he says to them, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. And then he requests a burial site among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight, a place away from me, that I'm not so immediately reminded of that all the time, but in a respectful way. And he asks or appeals to them for that place. Now think about this. He's dealing with Canaanites. These are not men who are principled, godly men, who are generous by nature and by command. These are men who are, they're calculating. And he knows who he's dealing with because he's lived there for some time. Verse 5, the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord, you're a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you as grave for burying your dead. Now that might have been, says something about the maturity of Abraham's faith. That might have been an appealing offer for a man who's hurting after the loss of his wife. Can you imagine if you had lost a spouse or a child, perhaps, suddenly, and had no arrangements made whatsoever for burial, and somebody came to you and said, look, don't worry about that at all. Take our tomb. We've got a plot down at our Moore Gardens. We'll cover the burial. Just take that. You can realize how tempting that would be, because Abraham don't own any property except for Beersheba and the area around the well. But other than that, he don't want to own any property, and he don't want to bury her right square in the middle of Beersheba. And so he says, would you give me a place to bury her among your burial places? And they give him a tempting offer here. Take any of them you want. You're a prince among us. You're a great man. We've seen how you've grown, and you're in some ways we're befriending you. We're getting along, and we're living together. We're not at war with one another, and that's a great promise that you made Abimelech, and we're all thankful for that. So just pick out the grave. It would have been very tempting to me for a man who had a lesser faith to accept that offer and to receive it as gracious. I had somebody one time tell me, and there's truth to this, you need to learn how to accept a gift. And I remember saying to them, maybe so, that's really, really dangerous. Because sometimes there are strings attached to a gift, even if they're not said. There are implications that I gave you this gift, and no, there's no strings attached. But next week, when we disagree, you might need to be inclined to agree with me, since I gave you such a wonderful gift last week. So there are invisible strings that are only seen when there's conflict, and then you're expected to side with the person you might disagree with because they had beforehand given you some gift or been generous towards you. Abraham is wise, and he's faithful. And here's why I think it's so important. Abraham is thinking about the generations to come. Abraham's not going to be alive that much longer. He could have made a deal here and said, hey, we'll get this taken care of. I'm going to be out of here before long anyway, so let's just go ahead and get this property, and yeah, I'll take whatever. We'll go out and do that. Thank you for the generosity, and I'm going to be dead and gone and let my relatives deal with it. But Abraham also knows that if he dies, if he accepts this offer, and he dies, and they bury Sarah, and they bury him there, then somewhere at some point his son Isaac might come into conflict with the people of the land, and they'll do the same thing to Isaac. Were we not generous towards your father? Did we not do this? Did we not give him this burial place? Should you not therefore then ally with us? And so if he accepts the offer, he eliminates the freedom of his generations to follow God with all their heart and soul and mind without any strings or any contingencies involved in that. So Abraham's thinking now in terms of what can I do in my last days to make it, to facilitate the obedience of my son and the generations to follow, to go after God, the God whom I have met on Mount Moriah. And so Abraham wisely, verse 7, and respectfully, Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. And he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron the son of Zophar for me. Now, I don't know if he knew that Ephron was in the crowd, and he spoke generally and left it in Ephron's arena to respond back to him, or if he just didn't see Ephron. But Ephron is there why he speaks this. He says, speak to him for me, the son of Zophar for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field, for the full price. Let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. So now he says, thank you. You're obviously willing for me to bury my dead among you, and for that I appreciate you, and I bow and show humility before you before that. But appeal to Zophar, or to Ephron then, the son of Zophar, that I might buy this specific cave from him. Now he's introducing now purchase price. And so you see this unfolding. Now verse 10, now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth. Now think about the wisdom of this now. Abraham is appealing with humility to purchase the piece of land even after the overt generosity has been indicated that pick your choice. You're a prince among us. You're here with us. Just take your pick. It's yours. Abraham says, thank you very much, and I appreciate your willingness to allow me to bury my dead, but I really want to pay for this, and I'd like to pay for this specific one, this specific place. Well, Ephron, verse 10, was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth. So he kind of put Ephron on spot here, because everybody knows this is Ephron's property, and now he's been made an offer. And so he's speaking up here. Even all who went into the gate of the city saying, no, my Lord, hear me. This is what he's saying to Abraham. No, my Lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. So it's almost like Ephron is, he's going to hold fast to this. Whatever the offer was made at first was a very generous offer. And he's not going to be less generous and take money. So he's going to double down on that. No, my Lord. No, I'm not taking him. If you want that field, it's yours. You take it. I'm not going to back off on the generosity that's already been demonstrated in another place. I'm going to be just as generous. So this guy's working out his own pride among his own people. But Abraham is on a different agenda altogether. He's not negotiating that way. Abraham is negotiating for a place to bury Sarah, mindful of the effect that that negotiation is going to have on his descendants. I mean, that's thinking of the generations to follow, is it not? I mean, he could have said, okay, you offered me once, I'm offering you money. Now the man who owns the land says, no, don't take any money, just take the land. That's good enough. I mean, it was said in front of all the people, I've got all these witnesses here. You can't come back on me and say I didn't offer you something. I mean, it would have been so easy to do that. But Abraham is thinking of other things. He's thinking of things more important even than a burial place. The influence of the negotiation for the place of burial itself, Abraham sees as important to how the generations will follow him. He's teaching them if they're listening. Verse 12, again, Abraham bowed before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of all the people of the land, saying, if you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there. And finally, verse 14, Ephron relents somewhat. Notice how subtly he does this. But then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, my Lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what's that between me and you? So bury your dead. You see how he did that? In other words, I'm not going to tell you it costs this much, but I'm going to let you know how much it's worth while I'm giving it to you. And that's exactly what he's performing for his peers in the city gate. And Abraham is on a completely different track here. And so Abraham hears that. And Abraham, verse 16, listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field were within the confines of its border, were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of the city. One of the things that struck me about this passage years ago when I read that and as I was reading through, outside of the well in the Beersheba, the area around the well that Abraham dug, which in a sense Abimelech acknowledged, okay, the well is your possession. You dug the well there. You have rights to the well as the digger of the well. But other than that, the only possession that Abraham ever purchased in the promised land was a grave. And I just couldn't help but think, that's what your works get you. The only thing your wages can get for you in the promised land is a grave. But the possession and the living in the promised land, it has to be the gift of God. And I thought about it in terms of salvation. If you're working for your salvation, the only thing you've earned is a grave. But if you're waiting by faith for the possession of that salvation, then it comes by grace through faith, not by works, lest any of us should boast. In this case, Abraham's purchase in the promised land, the land promised to him, his only purchase that he bought with his own money, was a place to bury his dead. Not only his wife, but later himself, because he's buried there with her. It just struck me that way. So finally, verse 18, to Abraham, it was deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of the city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, so that the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. So lots of verses, but there's a principle that I see in these verses that I think is important, especially in regards to in application to those who are pursuing God and pursuing faith in God. I don't know when the pinnacle of my understanding of God will happen. It may happen at 100 years old. It may have already happened. But even now, at 57, I'm already thinking in terms of there are things that I may never grasp in regards to the glory of God. Things I may never taste. I've been promised these things, but they're not my possessions. And if they're not to be mine by the providential hand of God in my generation, what can I do from this day to my last day to prepare the way for the generations following me to experience those things? That's the way we ought to be thinking, really, all of our Christian life, particularly when we have children. But more so, when our children are grown and when our years are coming to their close and when all the signs are around us that there's an appointment nearing that we've got to keep. I think that Mount Moriah experience really shaped Abraham in such a way as that he spent the rest of his days making preparations that the generations that would follow him would follow God and come into the full possession of that experience. So sure was he that they would all one day do that, he viewed himself as an instrument of God in his last days by which they might finally experience the fullness of that promise. Is that the way you think of your life? That's the application. And I think when we don't think that, it suggests to me that we've not had the Mount Moriah experience. In other words, the more fully I realize the glory of God in salvation and in relationship with Him, the more I taste and grasp the power and glory and infinite worth of God and Christ accomplishing for me salvation and eternal life, the more those things become a reality to me, and the longer I live, the more I come to the conclusion that my life is very, very short and is coming to its close very, very soon. And all that I can do in this life, left to do in this life, to be faithful to the reality of those things, is to do all that I know to do to prepare the way for those who will follow me, that they might know at a minimum what I've learned of God, and hopefully far more than I've learned of God. That's why men have been preaching all these generations. That's why people have been serving. That's why people have been giving. That's why people have been going. That's why we don't live our lives in neutral. We don't just get saved and then just coast on to the grave. We get saved, and through sanctification, God molds and shapes and bends and breaks and twists and turns and shapes our faith so that we might receive more of Him. And then He brings us to this place in our life to where, whether it's an event or a sequence of events or the culmination of a bunch of events, we've come to know this God, and He is glorious, so much so that we finally realize that the rest of my life has to be dedicated to shaping the path for those behind me who do not yet know Him that way, to come to know Him that way. That's a goal for life. And that's convicting, because I think about my life in front of my children and my grandchildren and church members and acquaintances and all those things. And at 57, statistically, I might have 20 more years left, but we don't have a promise of the next day. And so every day, the more we see God, the more we taste of Him, the more we experience God that way, the more it ought to make us mindful of the past that we are shaping for those who are behind us today. And I'm struck by that, because that may mean taking some unpopular positions in our culture today, and positions that those very children whom we hope will follow us may reject us for and may become angry at us for. But we take that position not because we're trying to accommodate the affections of our children, but because we are trying to navigate for them a path that they might come to know this God who is driving us by our very experience of Him. And sometimes, most often I would say, that means decisions that are not popular in the world. In the world. I remember my mom telling a story. My grandmother came from sort of a holiness background, and they were, to a fault, I think, sometimes very, very legalistic. And she would not, no way, allow any of her daughters to put on lipstick. If you were putting on any lipsticks whatsoever, you were a Jezebel and on your way to hell. I mean, that's where she come from. And that had some negative effects on my mother and her sisters through their lives, I do believe. But when I think of my grandmother, I think of someone who is extraordinarily mindful of the guardrails they were putting in place in their children's life. I think she knew something of God. She misunderstood a lot about the grace and mercy of God, but I think she knew one thing: God's real. And I want my daughters to see this God who I'm seeing. And if they're smearing makeup all over themselves, looking like Jezebels, they're moving in the wrong direction, away from that God. That's just the way she perceived it. I don't agree with her position there, but I do sympathize with her motivation. She had seen God in such a way that she wanted to shape the way for the children who would follow her to see Him. And it had its effect. positively in some ways, because it at least drove home to them, to her children, that my mom believes there is a real God who takes seriously sinfulness. And all of my mother and all of her siblings all carry this fear of God, that God is holy. And that's a wonderful thing. The part they struggled with, that is, God is merciful and has provided for your righteousness, not demanded it of you, but provided it for you and accepts you on that on behalf of the righteousness of Christ. But see, what's missing in a lot of generations, maybe in our generations, is a generation that has experienced God in such a way that God so overwhelms them that they view their lives as for nothing more than to live in such a way as to facilitate those behind them to seeing this same God. So you can imagine the negative of this. The less I see of God, the less urgency I have to prepare a way for those behind me to see it. And without that way prepared for them, they see even less of God and they prepare even less. And then that generation sees even less of God and they prepare even less. And the next thing you know, we are in a world of complete and utter darkness where there is no knowledge of God. The people are unrestrained. And where are we now? And that's frightening. So this is serious stuff. And you see it in the life of Abraham, I think, in these closing chapters. He's going to take care of one more thing before he goes on to be with the Lord and await the resurrection. He's going to look in chapter 24. He's going to take care of being actively involved in selecting a wife for his children, for his son Isaac. And we'll be reading about that soon. So stand with me tonight as we close. Just to ask you a question for consideration and thought, because I asked myself the same question. How mindful, maybe is the word, or how frequently do you think about the generations behind you and how the way you're living your life informs them or inhibits them? Which does it do more? How often do you think about that? I think it's something we ought to spend a lot of time thinking about. I really do. Father, thank you for your word. Lord, thank you for the life of Abraham, and we'll meet him someday. And Father, he's a remarkable man, but he is that because of your work in him. He wasn't remarkable, and so much so that you chose him. But Father, you chose him among other idolaters and called him out and created faith and belief in his heart. And he came to know you in an extraordinary way there on Mount Moriah as he offered up his own son. And Father, it seems to me from these passages that after that experience, he spent the rest of his life doing all that he knew to do and all that he could do to make it possible that those who would follow him would come to know the God that he had met. Father, thank you for that, and thank you most of all for Jesus Christ, who done all that is necessary for us to know that God. And I pray that we would be mindful, Lord, having met you, that we would be mindful of how we live our lives and whether or not that way will be helpful to the generations who follow us. Lord, as I'm saying that, I ask you to bless the children in this church. Father, I thank you for their parents who are devoted to you and are bringing them up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. But I just pray that you would just put a special spirit upon these children, Father, that you would draw them into fellowship with yourself early, Lord, that you would give them minds that are open to instruction from your truth. Lord, I pray that you would use them in mighty and glorious ways to display your glory and to advance the truth of the kingdom of Christ. And Father, help us as the older folks in the church family, help us to be communicating and living mindful of how our life's influences and decisions will help them become that. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.